Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Lunch Therapy. I'm your host, unlicensed lunch therapist Adam Roberts. My guest today is the owner of one of the coolest cookbook stores in the country, maybe the world, Omnivore Books in San Francisco. Her name is Celia Sack, and I'm a huge fan of hers. Not only has she exposed me to some of the coolest cookbooks in my collection, but I love to follow her on social media, where she tweets and Instagrams as Omnivore Books. In today's session, we talk all about the food that Celia ate growing up.
The only thing I wouldn't eat, of course, was anything shaped like an animal. Like, she'd make a really cute pancake in the shape of a bunny and I would start crying.
Her time in middle school.
By the time I entered, I was like obviously a lesbian but really bad at sports. So I had nothing going for me at all.
And the most valuable cookbook in her collection.
The first edition of a Renaissance cookbook that was the first book to picture a fork and the first cookbook to actually have illustrations in it.
So without further ado, here is my lunch therapy session with Celia Sack. All right. Well, hey, Celia, thank you so much for doing lunch therapy.
My pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
You know, I think of all my patients, you and I had the most intimate beginning to all this because you've never used Zoom before.
That's right. That was a big hurdle to get over for us.
So we had to walk through that together. But
yes, it was good though. Now I'm here and I'm confident-ish. I even put on a little makeup.
Well, you were saying, oh, you look lovely. You were saying though that you hadn't used Zoom at all during the pandemic, which is amazing for a business owner.
My Paula and I were like, you know, we're going to make this our goal to never have to use Zoom because it sounds horrible from everything we're hearing. Paula's brother is a teacher and he was just hating being on it. And everyone that I knew, you know, with both of our stores, she runs the pet store that's next door to ours that we also own together. And so the two of us are just so used to interacting with people all the time and in person, and we really value that. So we just didn't want to get into a habit of connecting over video. It just seemed like a slippery slope.
And here I am ruining everything for you.
Yeah, well, it's okay. We're right at the end. So yeah. I think Zoom is definitely going to fade out for sure.
I know. I wonder how their stock is doing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, so Celia, so before we get into your therapy session, which we're going to go very deep, but I think, as a starting point, though, I guess a good question would be, how did you fare during the pandemic with your bookstore? I mean, how did it go for you? Was it difficult? Because people love to cook. I mean, people started cooking more in the pandemic. So I'm curious how that was for you.
Yeah. I mean, I keep saying, you know, if I owned a travel bookstore, I really would have been in bad trouble. But having a cookbook store was really, really good. People really did need to cook a lot. And a lot of people needed to learn how to cook. The only thing I really hated was that my success was sort of at the cost of so many restaurateurs who are my customers and friends and colleagues losing business, which was really hard to watch. Mm-hmm. But so many people responded and came in, and we really upped our online sales and game and, you know, I had always just had books on there that I thought were hard to get because I figured everyone would just get books on Amazon if they want to buy it online. So they were books that you couldn't find there. Mm-hmm. But I was really wrong. People really were willing to support me and pay full price from like Alabama. You know, people I'd never even heard of were coming out of the woodwork and buying things from me that were, you know, probably 40% off on Amazon. So it was really heartwarming and surprising to me that people were doing that.
I bought a box from you that had Melissa Clark's Cooking in French. I'm trying to think what I got. It was like a bunch of books that had just come out at the beginning of the pandemic.
But
I was happy to do it. I mean, I'm curious, like, was there a trend in terms of the kind of books people were buying during the pandemic?
Oh, totally. I mean, it went in several phases that went along with the whole pandemic. You know, at first it was all bread baking.
Oh yeah. One of the books I bought from you was Artisan Sourdough, or one of those sourdough books. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It was almost all sourdough. Yeah. Well, we were, you know, the publishers ran out. We ran out, you know, the publishers, it was really interesting. So many of the books that they had had on their lists for years, suddenly everybody wanted it. And so they all went out of print with each phase of the pandemic that came in of popularity. So first it was all the bread books and everyone was totally into it. And then after about 3 or 4 weeks, you could tell every single person was like, fuck this. I'm not doing it anymore. And the sales just stopped of those.
Oh yeah.
It was like musical chairs, like, ah, oh no, we have like a huge pile of.
That's so funny. Yeah, my sourdough starter has died an ignoble death in my refrigerator. Yeah.
Exactly. You're not alone. You'll be left. Yeah. But so many people had these, it was just crazy. So then we're stuck with all those. And then in March, of course, the Black Lives Matter movement really caught on fire again. I mean, people forget that it had been going before that, but really picked up, and everyone wanted books about African-American culture and cuisine. And so those books that had been out for a long time, you know, Edna Lewis or Toni Tipton Martin's book, Jubilee, all mm-hmm. of those started selling out like crazy. Bryant Terry's vegan African cookbooks, they all were like impossible to get. So
wow.
That was really cool. And those have continued to be popular, but still they, you know, at some point it did, you know, after the publishers reprinted everything, those kind of died back down to their more regular popularity, which is still very popular.
But I have to ask, like during that period, without naming names, because we all know who maybe I'm talking about, but like as people were called out during that period, did you find that their books, cookbook sales went down?
Yeah, that was another thing that just like stopped very suddenly after being super popular.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, so it's interesting. People are just sort of clawing back now to the actual content of those cookbooks, which is actually really, really good, I have to say. So
what was the next trend after Black Lives Matter? Was there another trend?
Then it just got into more the seasonal stuff, which is what we see every year. So, you know, as the summer hits, it's barbecue books and books for mom and things like that. And then it gets into the fall and one pot meals and cooking like that. And then everybody's doing all the big, so cookbook publishing, there are two times of year that the big cookbooks come out from publishers, and that's spring and fall. And the fall ones are kind of the heavy hitters. Mm-hmm. So in fall, all the heavy hitters come out and everybody starts buying them for Christmas and as presents and for themselves. They get very excited. And one thing we never used to have on our website was pre-orders of stuff. We just had it that you could, you know, once it came out, we would put it up on our website, but we started to realize that people really wanted to pre-order things in advance, and we would get the publisher to, usually people come out and give a talk at our store and then we get them to sign it. But of course, last year we couldn't. So we got the publishers to promise to send us signed bookplates mm-hmm. for the books. And that was a huge help. Like The Dessert Person by Claire Saffitz.
Oh yeah.
You know how many of those we sold since it came out? Oh. 600.
Wow. 600.
I'm a 500 square foot space bot.
That's amazing.
Incredible. And the majority of them were shipped afar. And so that was incredible, all because they gave a signed bookplate. So now they're starting to see, oh, if we give these cookbook stores bookplates ahead of time, or, you know, promise them ahead of time, they'll put that on the pre-order and then the author will post about it. And then we get all these orders. So that just happened with the new Tartine Bread book. And it's not just me. It's happening for Now Serving down in LA and Kitchen Arts and Letters and Book Larder. So, which is great.
And do you personally, like if you were out buying a cookbook for yourself, does having a signed cookbook mean something to you? Cause I'm just curious, like I have a lot of cookbooks and I have some of them signed because I'm friends with their authors, but what do you think? I'm curious if that means anything to you.
Yeah, I have to admit, I have some here that are signed, you know, they're inscribed to me from Alice Waters or
Adam Roberts.
Yes, Adam Roberts, Renee Redzepi from Austria. You know, some of the people that I've met, it is really nice to have them. And of course I love that they're like, you know, thanks so much for hosting me.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Totally cool. It's a dream come true.
And that's really personal. Yeah. That's like a personal address to you. I mean, I think just the signature is almost like baseball cards, you know, when you were a kid or something.
It is. Yeah. But, you know, I was the head of modern literature at an auction house for a long time. And so I have to admit, I kind of got caught up in that. Like I would buy, if, for instance, you know, like John Updike would come to give a talk in San Francisco and I would buy a bunch of his older books, first editions of his older books, and I would take them to get signed by him. Not to sell. I mean, I know that it gives them value, but I just wanted them for myself and it was really fun. And you feel like you're offending them if you ask them to just sign it, because that does make it more valuable if it's not personalized. But but I would always, I just didn't have the chutzpah to say, we just not sign it to anyone. So I would always say, can you sign it to me? But John Updike actually said, would you mind if I just inscribe the first one to you and the rest I just sign? And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I totally.
Please. Yeah. That's so interesting. I got one of my favorite authors is John Lahr, who wrote the Tennessee Williams biography.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And he wrote a book about Joe Orton, the gay playwright from like London.
Yeah,
and Prick Up Your Ears. And that was one of my favorite books. And I went to a New Yorker festival event to get him to sign it. And he wrote the most like obscure thing inside of it. I can't remember what he wrote. It was just like, it was like a riddle. It was like, Adam, the pictures may have meaning, but I was like, I don't know what this means.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, the best actually, so for me, what I love most are what's called an association copy. Mm-hmm. So it's from one person to another, and both are well known for something or have an association with each other.
Ooh.
So some of my collection is vintage, like, early lesbian literature.
Okay.
That is inscribed, like Radcliffe Hall, The Well of Loneliness, inscribed to her lover.
Ooh, okay.
And, you know, and from John Radcliffe Hall, which was her sort of her pen name that she used, or not her pen name, her name for herself. So, you know, or with that partner's book played in it. And so I have a bunch of those that are really cool. I have one by Vita Sackville-West that's also signed by her husband Harold, and things like on each of their poems. So I love books that bring characters together from history mm-hmm. into one place at the same time.
Well, it makes me think of books as objects too, because it's sort of like mm-hmm. as a collector, it's sort of like they work on two levels. You can read them and enjoy them, but also it's like an artifact or like an Indiana Jones like thing that you get
exactly. Exactly. I've got a book from that belonged to Elizabeth David, and she inscribed it to Jeremiah Tower, the chef from.
Oh, Stoke, wow. Yeah.
Saying like in memory of the wonderful summer we spent together. And I was just like, yes, this is so cool. It's got, and I have one from James Beard inscribed to MFK Fisher about something that they spent together in Paris. So, I mean, and those are all my personal collection, but those are, you know, it's so cool because it puts them together. Oh, they were together at this time and playing together and knew each other. It's cool.
Well, I could talk to you about cookbooks all day and maybe we'll get more into that, but we have come to the moment for us to find out what you had for lunch today.
All right. So I thought long and hard about what I wanted to have for lunch today. On my days off, I have a favorite place to go, and it's over in the Richmond district, and it's called Bun Mi. And it's just a really great Vietnamese sandwich place, and they have other Vietnamese dishes. So I got my favorite, the grilled pork bun mi that has pate, liver pate on it, and this delicious smoky grilled pork on it, and and spicy jalapenos and cilantro and the works, and it's a perfect crunchy bread, and it's just like such comfort food and homey, and I absolutely love it.
Well,
so that is what I had.
Yeah, there's a lot to work with there. I mean, we might need 2 hours. No. Well, but actually, the first thing that I'm responding to is, you know, it's just interesting the different people I've had on this show that I've had. Food people, and then I've had comedians and writers and people who are not, or directors who aren't necessarily in the food world. And the way you just described the sandwich was so enthusiastic and so specific. So I guess my first question is, how and when did this fascination with food happen? And did it precede your fascination with books, or was books first or food first?
Very good question.
Yeah.
I think books first, then food, then cookbooks. Yeah, so I was really, really into books. In fact, ironically, this restaurant is just down the street from the first bookstore I ever kind of worked at, where I fell in love with the girl who worked behind the counter and then worked my way behind the counter too. And really taught me about used book selling and book scouting, which is like one of my favorite things in the world to do, just like hunting around for good used books. So that was a delicious thing for me that I have savored for a long time. Mm-hmm. But I guess when I moved back to San Francisco after college, when I went to New York for college, I got an internship at Christie's, the auction house.
Okay.
And really continued my love of rare things. I was in 19th century European paintings, but I was still collecting rare books, all these early signed Edward Gorey books that they would have at bookshops in New York.
Just to rewind the clock for a second though, yeah. as a kid, were you a big reader?
Yes, I okay. loved to read, you know, Harriet the Spy was one
oh, yeah.
of my favorites. Of course, and you know, yeah. all of those books from the 70s were and early 80s. But I was also like a tree climber. I was very much outside
okay.
all the time. Always scraping myself up, running around the neighborhood.
Interesting. So that kind of makes
but
sense.
But I was also yeah. really into digging in through people's stuff. Like the block I grew up on, which was in San Francisco, had a lot of Victorian houses. And one feature of those is that their doors usually on the stairs that go up to the house, there's a door under it that leads to where people keep their garbage cans. But you can go in and close the door and be private in there. And so okay. I would go around as a kid. I love to go into other people's and go through their junk mail that they've thrown out but not opened and pretend it was to me. And
that's really interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so very interesting. And then I was an early dumpster diver before homelessness was an issue here. I was always into dumpsters and digging through and finding, you know, of course I was a stamp collector, so I would find, you know, cool stamps on things, but I find all sorts of things and sort of make up stories about a pretend life. So that was, you know, so my interest in like book scouting and digging through other people's lives and experiences, I think, has been the long time thing.
Well, it makes me think about your relationship to objects, like mm-hmm. things. Like, it makes me wonder, like, when you were a little kid, did you have like a drawer full of treasures or like?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Right. Yeah. It's really interesting. I don't know what that means. I'm not advanced enough of a lunch therapist to know what the significance of things are, but I do feel like possessions and like holding on to things it does reveal something psychologically. Maybe we can explore what that is.
I'm from a family of collectors. A big collector, so I think that sort of came naturally to me. But I was so into I would dig through the gutters. I mean, I sound like a sewer rat, but really I would go into the gutters of around the house, like, or you know, like on I grew up on Sacramento and Visadero Street, so right at the corner. I remember every time too, it must have driven my parents crazy because I always did find like money or rings and things like that. Like, I was always rewarded for this. I never got like a rat that I pulled out. I actually would like get a wedding ring or something really valuable. So it was always proved to be the correct thing. But I didn't really get into food, I think, until my partner Paul and I got together in like 95 and or 93. We've been together 25 years. So a while since I was 25.
Oh my gosh.
And we just, a long time. But we both just slowly got into food. It was really fun how we sort of discovered it together. And I remember us really making fun of this cookbook that everybody had called Sunday Suppers at Luquez.
Oh yeah. Well, I love that.
Always calling it that. Yeah. But we thought it was hilarious. Recipe had like one thing we had never heard of in it, and we just thought it was so funny. And then we found ourselves down in LA one weekend, and someone said we should go to this restaurant, Luke, and we didn't know what it was. And so we found our way there, and we're like, oh my god, it's Lucas. So we've just been saying it wrong all this time, and that was kind of an awakening for us. We just fell in love with that food after having made fun of the cookbook
of the way it was pronounced. Well, it's
and the recipes. And so then we got into it, and then we're like, well, let's go look at that cookbook actually and see if we can make any of this.
It was sad because they closed during the pandemic, which is really, really sad. I mean, Suzanne Goyen, who is the chef there, she's one of those. I feel like LA has its secret group of chefs that like don't like really break through the like East Coast media. Like you don't see them on the cover of magazines and stuff, but it's like Nancy Silverton's pretty famous, but I just feel like LA kind of keeps its chefs kind of within its own borders.
Yes, those guys from Animal.
Oh yeah, John and Vinny.
Never hear of them outside of it.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, now this is a strange question, but I did take a psychology class once, and my teacher, well, so I accidentally went to law school. That's a whole other story. And
so many people I know accidentally went to law school.
When I was there, this teacher, I think her name was Martha Duncan, I think, wrote a book called Beloved Prisons, Romantic Outlaws. And a lot of her book had to do with like people actually wanting to go to prison, like repeat offenders who go to prison. But it also had to do with like gunk and like slime and like people's fascination with like, like the way kids play with like, you know, slime goo. And you make it goo. Yeah. And for some reason, I don't know why, when you were talking about being in the gutters and like pulling out things. And then I was thinking about like cooking, like, do you see a connection between like getting your hand in a bowl of like meatloaf and like mixing the meat together and like being in the gutter and pulling out?
Yes, I guess I do. I mean, especially like mud. I used to love, when I was growing up, we had a farm up in Healdsburg in the wine country, but it was not vineyards. It was actual farm. And I loved walking around barefoot all year round there and, you know, squeaking through the mud and digging through things and finding insects. So that makes total sense.
Yeah. And it's really interesting to think about your relationship to cookbooks, because it is kind of the perfect thing for you because of your love for touching things and like being, because mm-hmm. it's like a book that's about actual like actions and doing stuff. I don't know. As opposed to like a book, work of literature, which is more in the head opposed to like
not as actionable. The only thing that really comes up against that theory is my love for animals. And I mean, I always remember, because I really love eating meat, but I love animals. And I'll never forget when I was like 10, I went to I must have been like 13 or 14 because I went by myself, but to an animal rights rally up at Davis, UC Davis. And I remember sitting in the back of the bus eating my roast beef sandwich.
You ate a roast beef sandwich on the way to an animal rights rally?
I know. That's how much I liked my roast beef sandwiches then. I was one of those people that had to have like the same sandwich for a whole year every day. It was a little OCD. But anyway, I really, so while I love getting my hands in there and everything, I've never killed an animal. I've never had to go through heavy duty butchery. And, we own the pet store, we were dog walkers for 10 years. And so that's the only little bit of a dichotomy there.
Right. Yeah.
But I love meat. I can't help it. So I do eat it, but I'm one of those annoying people that's like, I can't watch it die.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like you're in the center of mindfulness in terms of like people being conscientious about everything from like composting to like,
you know, true.
So do you find like living in San Francisco that sometimes it can be overwhelming, like deciding whether to get like organic, local?
Totally. I mean, luckily there are enough stores like Buyright, which is wonderful, that you don't even have to choose between them. Everything in there is well chosen. If it's not organic, then they chose it because it's close by or they have a good reason for it. You can really trust the fishmonger, that's a really rare thing. Usually you don't know where your fish is coming from and they're very trustworthy. So I'm pretty solid on especially my meats and fish going from organic places.
Although
because the taste is better, really.
I agree, but it's so interesting what's happening right now, because in LA, Bel Campo Meats,
which was
so expensive. Terrible. Yeah. And that's like they were getting it off the truck that like sells it to the mass market supermarket. So it's like, how do you know who to trust?
I don't even see how they can reopen. I mean, really, I read that and I was like, no, that trust is gone, because the trust, like what I was saying about the fishmonger, that trust is it's like the trust in a marriage. You know, if you break that, to build that back up is going to take a long, long time.
But it also happened at at the Willows Inn on Lummi Island in Washington State. There was that big expose that he was like serving. I went there with Craig, but he was like, and we thought it was the most incredible food we'd ever had. But it was like the chickens were coming from Costco and the scallops were.
I love the guy in that article who said it's not even like physically possible to feed that many people from the food on our island in a week.
Yeah.
It's like 2 days worth, you know? So do the math. Like, oh yeah.
All right. Well, we have to steer this back to you and your story. Okay. But so I feel like we left something out because you talked about your childhood. You talked about collecting things. You talked about having a girl you had a crush on starting in the book industry.
Yes.
Christie's. And then I think we missed the beat where you got into cookbooks.
Oh, well, when I was working, so then after I graduated from college, I moved back to San Francisco and got a job at an auction house out here that was all rare books. And I became one of two specialists there. We wrote all the catalogs and did all the research and descriptions. And I was the head of modern lit, but also you became a specialist in whatever came through. So you'd never know this about me, but I am the like rare golf book specialist or at least I was for a number of years.
Wow, I had no idea.
You would get one good collection or one so-so collection, sell it, do well with it, and you'd start getting better and better collections. And whichever one of us had had time to catalog that original group became the expert in it. So I became an expert in that, in angling books, and you know, all sorts of weird things. But the books on food were the ones that were the most interesting to me. And particularly, I mean, I love the cookbooks, but particularly the ones that said something about the culture of the place. So I love like the colonial Indian cookbooks that are so interesting because, you know, half of them tell you to avoid anything that was like created there. You don't want to, you know, don't trust the servants. You should just give them extra money when they go to the market because they're going to steal from you anyway. Just terrible stuff. Yeah. But then half of them embrace the culture and embrace the food and want you to try things and are respectful of the native cooks from those places. So it's really interesting to see that. And then I really loved the books that were about, and still have a collection of these, of books that are about how to open your own retail store, which was interesting to me anyway, because, you know, I went on to open the pet store. So I really love retail in general and that psychology. But there's a whole series that used to be published that they don't do this anymore on like how to, a great butcher shop one I had, how to set up your butcher shop with your glass cases. And it's so English. It's like sheep's head, sheep's stomach, sheep's heart, fern in pot. You know, or there's one called roadside marketing, and it's all about, it was from 1920s, all about now that cars are in existence, they can come all the way out to your farm to buy from you. They don't have to buy in the city. And so this is how you set up your roadside stand. If you're in a dip in the road, do it like this. If you're on a hill, do it like this. And this is how to talk to your customers. If they complain, this is what you should say. You know, I mean, I just love that. I love the idea. And I have books about how sign writing and, you know, that whole thing just fascinated me. And I found that the most books on those subjects were in the food area. And it just sort of led me into the cookbook arena.
And it's so interesting. Well, I was just going to say, it's like an interesting way, like an angle on history. It's like, instead of like having to sit there reading a dusty, boring history book, it's like you're actually reading something kind of fun and unexpected that has history within it, you know?
That's right. It brings it alive in this way that you weren't expecting, because it does tell you about the people and their culture, wherever it is. There's a really cool one I got recently that I was going to sell, and then I was like, I have to keep this. And it was from Nigeria, from like 1956, I think. And it was the first cookbook published by a Nigerian woman for young women there. She also taught cooking there, but she had learned and she grew up there, but she had also gone to school in England and came back. And, you know, she's saying, now, girls, I know that you're thinking that it's silly to use measurements because your aunts and grandmothers all don't use that, but you're forgetting, what you don't realize is that they had many, many mistakes, and many dishes were thrown out and much food wasted because they had to learn how much. And this is, you know, I'm going to teach you how to use measurements. And all the measurements were in cigarette tins. And then there's sections on like, if you're in the countryside, this is how you make a stove. You know, if you're in the city, you have a stove. If you're in the countryside, you know, put two kerosene cans, you know, like so, and then you put a board over it. And this whole thing on sort of making your own fire and in the countryside and how to cook on it. And, you know, it's just telling me so much about the countryside, about the city, about the difference.
What was that book called?
It's called Miss Williams's Cookbook.
Oh, wow. I love that. That's a great title. Yeah. It's funny. When I got into cooking, my mom, I don't know if she still has this, but like her father, when she got married in like 1970 something, her father's like coworkers' wives, like put on like recipes for her to make. So she's,
that's great.
Yeah. But it's interesting to see that stuff. And you know, it's all like, you know, margarine and like sweetened or saccharin.
Yes, totally.
Well, I have to ask, okay, so I'm a huge cookbook fan, a huge cookbook collector, and this is nothing, this has nothing to do with your psychology at all, but I must ask you, like, what are the most valuable cookbooks out there? Like, what are the ones that like are the holy grail? Like, if you found it in a estate sale, you'd be like, oh my God, I found it. Like, what would that be?
Well, I just bought one of them as my pandemic present to myself, which was the first edition of a Renaissance cookbook that was the first book to picture a fork and the first cookbook to actually have illustrations in it. So it was,
and what's it called?
It's, it's a long title, but it's by Bartolomeo Scappi, S-C-A-P-P-I. And it's Renaissance Italy, 1570. And it's just got these wonderful illustrations of cooking over fire, of knives, forks. And it's a really cool one. You're not going to find it probably in a used bookstore, but it was probably like, I think I paid $5,100 for it. And that was actually really fair.
And is it the original like paper and the original? I mean, it's all.
Yeah. And it's an early binding. It's probably, so most books pre-1900 came disbound or in, you know, paperback that you would take to your binder and have them rebound. So all those bindings, you're not going to find an original binding, but it's probably from the 1700s. So it's a pretty early binding.
So do you put gloves on when you look at it, or do you?
No.
Just tear it up.
I mean, part of the whole thing in my store, I feel like as a young collector, I was so turned off to going into fine and rare bookstores because they were so snooty about it. And they always had the, you know, the better books behind the counter, and they, you know, would sort of give me the stink eye if I wanted to look at stuff. It wasn't until I started piling up books to buy that they were like, oh, okay, I guess she's okay. But it was so annoying. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to trust my customers to not throw the book across the room when they get in.
Yeah.
And I want to be the gateway drug for collectors. Like, it's sort of like opera. Like, the fans are dying out, and we need new collectors and young collectors.
Well,
and
you know,
open up.
And let people touch it. Well, it's interesting. At Christmas, a couple of Christmases ago, Craig called you and said, would you put together some books for Adam for Christmas, or Hanukkah as I celebrate, but it's usually Christmas because it's with his family. And you sent some really rare and interesting books, which I have on my shelf, but I don't want to
get
up. But there was like one was called Punches. It was like Punch.
Yes.
And that was really cool. It's like really old. Like, and then there's an amazing one that you sent that was Toasts. It's like famous like Toasts the people, but like that felt very rare, and like, you know, and do you remember like what that was?
Of course. I mean, I loved putting that together for you
because I loved so getting it
to go around and think about what you were gonna like and what was cool on the shelf. And but, you know, as rare as certain books are like that, or some of the really early African-American cookbooks or Southern cookbooks are really hard to find, oftentimes because of weather or because of earthquakes. There's a San Francisco one that was very rare because a lot of the copies got destroyed in the earthquake. There are so many more that are not that rare that you don't have to wear gloves for, that I do trust that you're going to pick up at my store and love. And, you know, and that's what I want people to, I mean, great if you want to collect, you know, and have the first book ever written about olives from the 1500s. I will find that for you. I actually did find that for someone once. I will find it for you. But I also want people to be able to just have a shelf of them and not be afraid that, you know, that they shouldn't have it or shouldn't touch it.
That's well, I remember at your story when I came into your story, which, by the way, I should say, and I'll say this in the intro, it's one of the most beautiful cookbook stores in the country or the world. But I remember I got a book there. I think it was from your store. Maybe it was. Now I'm like going to be embarrassed, but I think it was. It must have been from your store because it was like a gay Jewish like cookbook for like the community, like during the AIDS crisis. It was like, it was like so specific.
It was for a temple just down the street from here, Shamar Zahav.
And that's I love that book because it's so, like, I feel so connected to it, obviously because I'm gay and Jewish, but also because it's so specific to its time and its place. And anyway, we can go on and on, but we have to go back to your sandwich. So, okay. So now the other part of all this was like the San Francisco of it all. Like, it seemed as you were, because like, I try to listen when someone's describing their lunch. Like, that's my moment to really like key in. And you talked about the district in San Francisco where it was, which was
the Richmond.
Richmond district. So I guess your sense of place, you say you grew up in San Francisco. So can you talk a little bit about being tied to where you are and how long, and have you lived there your whole life or have you?
Pretty much. Yeah. Except for those 4 years at Sarah Lawrence. I've been here. So since 1969 and you know, it has changed a lot, but there are also parts of it that are so much still similar to what I remember as a kid, and especially those neighborhoods where minorities live and have lived and still live. The Richmond is one of them. That's largely Asian neighborhood, though it also used to have a lot of more Russians, but it still does have a bunch of Russians. But especially when I was growing up, it was people who had gotten out of the Bolshevik Revolution and with their jewels intact and came here. But that area is just wonderful, and it's evolved over time but still is an all Asian neighborhood. It's just got more modern restaurants along it, and same with Chinatown, which I absolutely adore. And the Mission, you know, I love walking down Mission Street, which is one block off of Valencia, which has gotten very popular. Valencia was like lesbian neighborhood. You'd like trip over someone with the rain stick on the way. You wear your like lesbian Guatemalan pants, the whole thing, in the hot tub place called Ocento. And there was a women's bookstore called Wise Woman Books there. Okay. You know, it was a very different feeling than it is now, where it's a very popular shopping street now. But Mission Street, one block away, has really not changed very much. And I mean, there are a few sort of gentrified spots along it, but not much. You still get the stores with like the half mannequins with pants on. And I mean, it's just so fun. And those are the places that I feel the most at home walking down the street, because it just, you know, reminds me, like La Taqueria, which I argue always is the best taqueria in the city, is on Mission and 25th. And the first time I went there was with my sixth grade Spanish class.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I've been ordering the same, and the same people work there and own it. And I've been ordering like the same order since then. And
what is it? What's your order?
Carne asada, a taco with carne asada, cheese, and a small melon, which is the cantaloupe drink, and cheese quesadilla to go with it.
That sounds delicious.
So good.
So I think what's occurring to me is, like, you know, when people flee the city that they're from, it's usually to get away from their families or like the culture they grew up in.
That was the only downside to staying here.
Well, I was going to ask you, like, did you have a good relationship with your family growing up? And
I mean, I mean, as a teenager, I could not wait to get away. I really was scratching to get out. I'd had a miserable time at my school that I had to go to after my elementary school ended. So my junior high school was this place called Marin Country Day School. By the time I entered, I was like obviously a lesbian, but really bad at sports. So I had nothing going for me.
That's a double bind.
It was a double bind. Nobody,
that's like being a gay boy. yeah, being bad at drama club or something.
Exactly. It was horrible. And then I came out in high school, and I was sort of having an affair with a woman that I worked with at Cole Hardware. Such a stereotype. but my parents were really pissed about it, and they, you know, so we fought all the time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. I mean, they, you know, it was part, a big part of the fighting was that all of their friends had been gay, and almost all of them died during this crisis, which was horrible. I mean, at least a dozen, if not more, of their very close friends. And so the irony of them being unhappy with my coming out just made it so much more angering and upsetting.
I've never heard that story. Like, I've never heard that dynamic before. Like, most of my friends who struggle with their parents when they come out, it's like religious reasons or Republican thing, you know.
And these were all guys that I grew up with, like every single day coming home and they were at the house. So it didn't, you know, well, we don't want it to be hard for you, honey. You know, they were from the South and they're just, I mean, they weren't going to not accept it, but they just wanted to sort of, I think, put it off for a while. Right. They just weren't ready for me to be, I was 16 and she was 28. And they just they just didn't want to deal with the adult nature of it, I think.
And what brought your parents to San Francisco in the first place?
Being from Jacksonville, Florida, they just really wanted to get away.
Yeah.
Apparently they caused a scandal by leaving, but luckily they left. They got here the year before I was born, so I have to thank them for that. But they're still here, and when I was in college, but they live like there, it's actually very sweet. So we're close now, and they live about 5 blocks away from each other. And my mother remarried, and so my mom turned 80 last weekend, and her husband 88 and my dad is 86, and they all they take each other to their colonoscopies together. they travel together, they go to the opera together. They're like, I keep saying they're like lesbians. It's really cute.
They learned from you. Yeah.
Yeah, really. They just all hang out together, and it's really, really nice. So, and it's a great, so then my sister moved back here from New York, and she and her husband have a son. And I love that he gets to see this sort of alternative family of all together and friends, and you know, it's just such a good,
it's sort of ironic that they were so disapproving of you and now they're in a throuple.
I know totally. it's so true. But they accepted me long ago, it worked itself out, especially once I got through college, and they also really didn't like this woman that I was with. And so once I got together with someone who was a little more stable, they were happy. And then now with Paula, my wife, they love her and she's part of the family.
Well, it's very poignant. Like, it's interesting because my parents, I mean, I'm a little younger than you, but not much. I mean, I was born in 1979. So you know, a lot of my childhood was like people dying of AIDS and just the red ribbons at the Oscars and all that stuff.
Right.
So when I came out, it was a similar fear of AIDS. I mean, that was just the hugest part.
I can imagine.
And I feel like the new generation that's coming out now, it's like they don't have that sense of like, this is a death sentence. And like, this
that's
is
right. Yeah. I mean, I kind of think that's why San Francisco got through this pandemic so well, because we had not only the same experience with a deadly pandemic, but the same doctor and scientist, Dr. Fauci, advising us. And so, you know, we were able to go, okay, you know, remember the last time we didn't take it seriously. We thought that they were just against the bathhouses and wanted to close down because they were anti-gay, and we were wrong. There really was a deadly pandemic that, you know, that we needed to protect ourselves from, and we didn't, and we lost so many people, and we're not going to let that happen again. So people were super careful here. I never in the entire year had a single person try to come in without a mask in my store. I mean, not once.
And did you stay open the whole time?
We had to be closed for just 2 months.
Okay.
So, but I mean, you know, people here were very, people still haven't, I mean, I'll go out at midnight to walk my dog and people are still wearing their masks outside. We can take those off now.
Here in LA. Yeah. I'm curious, just as a sidebar, because I was just thinking about cookbooks that were written by gay men who died of AIDS, because I know that there was Richard Sacks.
Richard Sacks. He was a pastry guy, and people I talked to loved him. I think Flo Breaker knew him, and you know, people who I've talked to really, really loved him a lot. And same with Felipe Rojas, who was a Peruvian a guy who was gay, and he wrote a lot about South American cookery, and he died also. Did you read that article in about Zuni Cafe? That was great.
Oh yeah, by John Birdsall.
Yeah. I talked to the sous chef, or not sous chef, the chef from there, Nate. It shops with us a lot, and I was at, so he came in the other day and we were talking about it, and he said he really didn't know any of that stuff about him, and he said it's like, I now that rock has turned over and I just want to explore and figure out more about him. That was really interesting, and I didn't know any of that history. So
this is a sidebar on a sidebar, but yeah. Did you see the movie Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Oh yeah, I love that movie.
I love it.
We just saw it a second time.
Oh yeah, because I was thinking about you, because it's about like forgering like class, you know, book collectors, lesbians, you know, in that whole era. So, okay, so I had to put that out there. Okay, we have to go back though. We're gonna return to your childhood just for a moment, because we left something out, which is pretty important, which is what kind of food did you eat growing up, and what kind of cooks were your parents?
Very health food oriented for my mother. She was really into a lot of bulgur wheat and bran, and it was very healthy. I didn't love it, but she also was a very good cook, and she could mix things in, like, you know, dirty rice, which actually had liver in it. She would trick us into eating things, or there was a fish stew. I always hated fish stew, but she called it the swamp. So then, of course, I loved it. And I wanted
the liver. You had liver on your sandwich today, so it worked.
Yes, that's right. It did work. The only thing I wouldn't eat, of course, was anything shaped like an animal. Like, she'd make a really cute pancake in the shape of a bunny, and I would start crying, which just probably made her so pissed off. And I totally don't blame her.
And there you were all those years later, eating roast beef on your animal rights rally. So, yeah, but you wouldn't eat the bunny pancake.
Like I said, as long as it doesn't have a face. I'm
okay. So do you not eat? Wait, will you not eat like a lamb head or whatever the chefs do, like pigs?
Oh no, I probably would.
I'm
enough of a gourmet that I couldn't pass it out.
When I was working for Serious Eats, it was right when they opened. It was like right when they started their website, and they had an event at Adam Perry Lang's like barbecue place in New York.
Wow.
And they got a whole pig, and we all put rubber gloves on, and it was like a whole smoked pig with his face staring at us. And then you just like reached in and grabbed a hunk of meat, and it was disturbing, but delicious.
I was oddly enough in Palau several years ago, which is near the Philippines. And we were at the inauguration of the president. It's a very long story, but there was a whole roast pig there, and like that. It was just, you didn't have to dig into it, but the face was there, and it was pretty intense.
So you mentioned earlier a little bit, you just kind of quickly glossed past it, but like being a little OCD about food.
And also I was just going to say about my dad.
Oh,
you were asking about what kind of food my parents made. My dad was, there are like certain things that I just can't eat today because they remind me of the things that he would make, because he was so bad at it, and still is. And he's so, the funny thing is, he loves a good meal, but he has a hard time distinguishing. Like, he'll have a chocolate cake at you know, Zim's, which is an old, you know, I don't even know how to, like an old diner, and say to clear out the best chocolate cake he's ever had. And then he'll go to restaurant Danielle the next night in New York, and he'll declare that the best chocolate cake he's ever had. He doesn't like, so he would make us corned beef hash from a can, or brisket that was just like leather, dry and horrible. And those are like the two main things I remember he would fall back on to make.
Are your parents Jewish?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, I'm Jewish. Yeah.
You're Jewish. Yeah, that all felt very Jewish to me. Like the and even the restaurant of it all, like loving like the deli, like chocolate cake, like my parents go to these restaurants where it's like, you know, like Italian American food, and they think it's like the best pasta. And then I'll take them to like something I read about in like Bon Appetit or like New York Times. They're like, oh, that was terrible. Like,
oh god.
Yeah. Well, like all that, like, you know, like authentic Italian, I mean authentic, but like, you know, pasta made by hand to them is not as delicious as like, you know, penne alla vodka.
Right. Yeah, I think the food he grew up with sort of in, you know, in the Depression era and wartime in Florida was not memorable, even though his mother grew up in Cuba and it should have been really interesting food. It was not. And so he's, you know, he's still... is like just as happy with, you know, salmon from a can as he would be from like a wild caught salmon
So when did your awakening happen in terms of like, when did you first like cook something or eat something where you're like, ah, there's a whole other world out there?
Actually, my first cookbook that I had was the one by Evan Kleiman about pasta.
Okay.
Pasta rustica. And I thought that I was really good at making it when I first moved back home after college and I had my first little apartment. And, you know, I realize now it was just awful. I mean, I would overcook this fettuccine and cut up bacon and just like throw it in. and probably button mushrooms, but it was an awakening nonetheless. And that really got me started on being interested in cooking and exploring it.
And when you mentioned, I just tried to bring it up earlier,
but okay, sorry.
The OCD, because you said, I just remember what you said, but you said that like you would eat the same roast beef sandwich every day.
Yes.
So what was that about? And like, where did that begin and when did that end?
It started really young. I would have like peanut butter and jelly sandwich every single day for lunch. And then, you know, the next year it was cream cheese and jelly. And maybe the next year after that, it was honey and peanut butter. But it was always like, I just needed, I don't know, somehow, I think I really needed the consistency of that. I didn't have a lot of, I didn't have as much consistency at home as I probably should have. It's so hard to remember, but one of the most important moments for me ever in an early therapy session I had was in talking about how independent I was as a kid, how I would go under these houses and go through the mail or climb trees around the neighborhood, or I'd crawl under people's houses and listen to their conversation. Like I was totally into that. And I had all these, there were all these shopkeepers around the neighborhood that I would check in with, that I considered myself friends with, but also I think were kind of keeping an eye on me. There was the corner store, London Market, where I would get my bazooka gum, and Joe was always there. And then there was another store on California, a couple more. And, you know, I just would stop there on my route every day on my bike. And I described to my therapist how I was so independent. And she said, did it ever occur to you that maybe you were independent because you had to be? I'm like, oh, no, it didn't. I always thought that I was independent because I was sort of proud of myself and I was just an independent person. But I think I kind of wasn't able to depend on a lot of consistency at home.
It makes me think of those objects we were talking about earlier and like, this idea of like creating your own little world where you could be in charge, like, and then it translates nicely to the bookstore. Cause it's like,
now you
have your own world filled with objects that you curate and it's your space and you can let in who you want to. And like, if somebody's coming in that you don't want, you know, it's like,
that's right.
You've created your own world for yourself. So it's kind of a beautiful continuation of the same idea.
And it's really fun, I have to say, to share it with other people. Like my collection here, I have a whole library filled with books, and for years, no one was interested in it. I mean, my partner isn't really into it. She's into it if I describe something to her, but she would never like ask on her own what something is. My friends weren't interested. And then one day I ran into a woman who was a customer of ours at the pet shop at the antiquarian book fair. And it turned out that she was writing a book about a book thief. It was a true story. It was really fun. And she wanted to interview collectors that were unusual. And so women, there are not that many women collectors, especially I think at the time I was like 30. So she asked if she could interview me and I said, sure. So she came over and she freaked out over my library and just loved it. And I thought, if I could have this all the time in my life, I would be so happy. And so I feel like what I've created is that, because these people are coming to me who have this passion and I can share it with them. And the way I've curated stuff, it's like a spider web. They go in and they get caught and they're totally. It makes me so happy because we show each other this mutual respect of loving the books. And it's just so fun for me to see them get a kick out of it. And I'm kind of a temporary collector now, where I can have these books for a little while and enjoy them. I catalog them, I put them on my website, and then I'll see them go either at the store or I'll put them on Twitter or Instagram. and people respond to them and buy them. And it's just like, oh my God, you know, or they'll say, like, I just had off the Mickey Mouse cookbook from 1975.
Oh, yeah, I think I saw that on your Instagram.
So many people wrote in like, oh, I used to make this from that. Oh, that was my first cookbook. And, you know, I just, oh, it makes me so happy to share that with people.
Oh, well, that's a lovely note to end your therapy session on.
Thank you.
Because I think it's like, I do feel like we came full circle, because I feel at the beginning, you know, with this idea of like you as a child and like crawling through the mud and I was trying to like connect the dots, but I do feel like it all is of a piece. But now yeah. I'm going to use these final moments to ask you tons of questions about cookbooks.
Okay. So you've given me so much to think about now.
Oh, good. I mean, I don't even charge anything. But,
I know, it's great.
Yeah. But I wanted to ask, okay, so first, like, because all these questions have been occurring to me as we've been talking.
Sure.
So, and this is like one of those cheesy questions, but if the store, God forbid, was on fire.
God.
I know, I'm sorry to say that. I know. I don't mean to trigger your fears, but what books would you grab first?
Oh, God. You know, that's so funny. I have thought about it with my house before, yeah. But I've never thought about it with the store.
Or your house. I mean, you could do your house too, if you want.
The house, it would be there's this rare Southern cookbook, but it was the second cookbook ever written by an African-American woman in the United States. It's called What Mrs. Fisher Knows About Old Southern Cooking.
Oh, I love that.
And she was, I'll tell you briefly the story because it is really cool. She moved from the South with her husband after slavery. She had been enslaved, came to San Francisco with their children, one of whom she had along the way, and started a pickling and preserving business. She won a bunch of awards for her pickles and preserves and wrote this cookbook. It came out in like 1881. It was published over in Oakland, and she was illiterate, but she had somebody else help her write it. And a lot of copies were lost in the earthquake, so there aren't very many. And I managed to find myself a copy.
Wow.
It was $4,000 then, but now it sells for like $10,000 online. At auction. It's very hard to find. And I've always loved it. And for a long time, until I got this copy last week, it was my most valuable cookbook. And recently, like a couple of years ago, the census records for African-Americans living in San Francisco came online, or for all of San Francisco came online, and you could find out where a lot of people lived. I found out she lived a block from my store.
Hmm.
And my store was a butcher shop at the turn of the century. And so that means she had to have shopped there.
That's so cool.
And I know. And I was like, why was I drawn to that book, mm-hmm. and, you know, and pay that much for it? And then it turns out that like she had for sure a connection to the space that I'm in now. And
it's beautiful that it's in your hands too. It's like, I can imagine a book like that just being in some like very rich person's house. Like, oh, that's what I've been, you know, this means nothing to me. But for you, it's like, you appreciate it so much and get so much pleasure out of it.
Yeah.
All right. What are the other two? Come on.
Okay. So let's see. My signed copy of Cannery Row by Steinbeck. Oh, okay. That's not a cookbook though. Should I be saying just cookbooks?
I mean, it's interesting, but no, I think you have to do cookbooks.
Okay.
Same theme here.
Oh, God.
Are we doing your house or are we doing the store now?
I guess we should go back to the store. I have some really behind the counter. I have one that I just sold, but I haven't sent to her yet, that Tony Tipton Martin just bought. It's the second ever cocktail book written by an African-American.
Okay.
And extremely rare because it was published in Montana. He was a bartender at a saloon in Montana. And it only went through three printings, but each one was just a paperback. This one's signed by him on the cover and super, super rare. So that I'd have to save because yes. There's only one copy known in the whole country and it's at the Montana Historical Society. So I would definitely have to grab that one.
Yes, you do.
and then the last one, there's a really cool old Mexican cookbook that is about cooking in Puebla, that from the 1800s that I think is a really, really special book.
Well, what's interesting about your answer to this question, now we can actually bring it back to psychology for a second, which is that I noticed that like the books that you saved are almost out of a sense of duty and like preservation. They weren't necessarily like personal to you, although the first one was personal to you because of the connection to it. But that's almost like you see yourself almost like the like, you know, the, I guess
caretaker.
Caretaker.
You're right.
Of these stories.
I do feel that way. I mean, that's so funny that you say that, because sometimes people will come in and pick a book off the shelf that has been there for like 7 years or something to buy it. And I always say to them, you know, this book has been waiting for you a really long time.
I love that.
So I feel very much like I'm the caretaker for a while, and then these are going to go to their proper homes. It's sort of like, you know, a collector gets all their stuff together. It's like making a dandelion, and then I'm there to blow on it and see them receive themselves in all these different libraries and homes.
That's so nice.
Yeah.
Well, I guess as a final question, because we ate up our time so quickly.
Yeah, I know.
Although I could keep you here forever. What are some books? This is a different, like, I'm approaching this differently now, that like are actually readily available, but that most people don't know about. Like, what are some cookbooks that like aren't like your,
mastering
the art of French cooking or something, you know?
Yeah, there's a fabulous publisher called Interlink, and they publish all these great cookbooks that are a lot of Middle Eastern and Georgian and like from places that you just would not expect at all. I really, really love those books because, and I feel like a lot of people don't know about them. They did a great Afghanistani one last year called Parwana. Mm-hmm. They just came out with an Egyptian one. They're just really, really interesting. They have an Iraqi cookbook, a couple Syrian ones called the Aleppo Cookbook. And I just love that they, a great mm-hmm. Ethiopian cookbook. So they've really paid attention for a much longer than the rest of the cookbook world has in on cultures that we are just so not that familiar with.
That's really cool.
My favorite title from them is called Mouneh, and it's this huge book of Lebanese preserving. The entire book, it's like a $45 tome all about pickling and preserving Lebanese cuisine. I mean, it's just I love that attention.
And people can go to your website and order
it. It's all on there.
Yeah. Okay, I have a controversial question to ask you that could open a whole can of worms.
All right.
I feel like you're game, even though we're at the end, but I just have to ask this. So what is, as a bookseller, what is your attitude about selling books by, I'm going to quote unquote, like bad chefs or like people who now have been exposed as, you know, I mean, the first one that comes to mind is Mario Batali. Yeah, but like,
luckily, I never really sold many of those anyway. Like, I don't sell any of the Food Network. I did have his, and I couldn't even sell them off at my half off sale at the end of the year. So I ended up just donating them to the library. But yeah, I try to not, I mean, there's certain ones, you know, we were referencing Alison Roman earlier, and I have to say,
I mean, I never said it.
No, I know. But I have to say, she's, you know, I stand behind her. I know her pretty well. We've gotten to know each other over the years with her coming to give talks. I really like her. I consider her a friend. And her books are wonderful. The cookbooks, yeah. I mean, the recipes in there, they work really well. I don't feel like she's a thief. I certainly think she misspoke and regretted it and tried to apologize. And I just have a feeling she put her foot in her mouth and didn't mean to lump two Asian American women together in what she was trying to say. And you know, I don't know who is well known who can say that they haven't done something like that mm-hmm. they've regretted. In fact, I once made fun of Mario Batali's children on Twitter and with John Bernthal, and he saw it, and that was like, oh, I just wanted to kill myself. I'm like, now I don't care, but
I've gone through that. Yeah, I've got my feet in hot water, as you know, when I did the piglet.
Like, okay, thank God, you know, I don't have to care anymore. Yeah. But you know, I mean, so we've all done stuff like that, but. I never carried Paula Deen books. I don't carry any Rachel Ray. I like books that are, they can be simple and easy, but they can't be dumbed down. And they can't be just like written by someone else in just a slapdash way. It has to be a good book. But yeah, the Lummi Island one, I have like three more signed copies of those. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with that.
I got into a huge fight with Craig.
Yeah.
Well, Craig bought that for me for Christmas this year because we went to that restaurant. And then when I read him the New York Times article, He's like, well, I still think we can keep that book because it's a memento of our trip there. And da, da, da. I was like, I don't know. This guy seems like a real asshole.
No,
and he got really mad. Yeah. I think it's a really interesting question because I got rid. I mean, Mara Batali, I mean, this is, we're on such a tangent here, but, but Mara Batali was the reason I got interested in cooking. I mean, I would watch her show religiously on the Food Network.
Yeah.
And when I was in law school, I was like, oh my God, look at that. And I would make like his lamb dishes. I'm like, wow, this is amazing. So, but at the same time, when I draw a distinction between Mario Batali's behavior and like physically harming women and physically like raping people versus like Alison Roman, who absolutely like made a mistake. And, but I think what happens on Twitter is people get lumped together and this idea of, I mean, quote unquote, cancel culture, but like, you know, it's like, once you've done your misdeed, it doesn't matter if you are Harvey Weinstein or it doesn't matter if you are just sweet, like a bad, you know, stupid thing. Like, it's like, well, to me, there is a difference between being Harvey Weinstein and Alison Roman.
Yeah. And you also get to this point where there's no amount of formulating an apology that will work. I mean, just, I advise people if I can, just don't go there because it's so, your apology gets made fun of. It's not good enough. It's not, you know, it's not sincere enough. It's just like, oh, it's a really hard position to be in. And it's, we all seem to learn that the hard way as we're sort of coming up and becoming more well-known and being interviewed more. And you just, you know, you think you're being honest and funny and off the cuff, and then you find yourself in hot water, and it's extremely stressful and hard to backtrack from.
Well, let's hope this podcast doesn't destroy either of our careers. No, but that was great. I'm actually really glad we talked about that because I think it's on everyone's minds a little bit. And I think in your position, you know, where you're kind of seeing all these books come through, it's interesting to hear your take on it.
Yeah.
Well, we did a great job, I think. What do you think?
Thank you so much. Yes, I have to say my first Zoom experience has been very positive.
Oh, good. Well, I hope this opens a whole new world for you. And I can't wait to come to San Francisco and come back to your store and buy some stuff.
Me too. I can't wait to see you in person again.
All right, Celia. Well, thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day.
Okay, bye. You too. Bye.